thank you for coming to this session. Next up, we have linguistic and metalinguistic training to support use of audio chunks in line revitalization from Mark Richards and Josephine Laurie.
Good afternoon, everybody. I'd like to acknowledge the people of Hawaii for letting us come here, the mob from in the past, now, and in the future, and also all the mob that have worked on the project and projects before, mainly one of the elders and my auntie, Aunt Sheila. Well, Thomas took away my big speech. I'm just going to read the title. Anyway, I was going to say, like, what does it mean and why it may be interesting to you, or you might be interested in it, but I'll let Mark go into that. That was supposed to be my joke, but Tom stood it. So what I'm just going to do is introduce where that project is being done, and it's in Northern Territory, Australia.
And we'll be.
And there might be a... Yep. You know where Darwin is? Not there. It's down this way. It's there. So it's another 140, 50 k's southeast, and there's about 350 people on the community, all are Aboriginal except for two, one of them being my dad. And there's only one fluent speaker of Māori on the community. There may be a few in other surrounding communities. Well, there's two, my other auntie, but she's in a home now in Katherine, but getting dementia and stuff. But when we go and use some Māori words with her, just bust out in language. So I want to try to take some back, what Mark's going to talk about, take some to her so she can listen to it and enjoy some language. There's probably second generation ones down from Aunt Sheila who can hear it and sort of understand it and can say a few words to put small sentences together, or if they're prompted or listening to it, they can understand it. So I'm probably third generation down away from it. So I use words or no words, but I can't speak fluent, like I put sentence together or anything. So this project has actually sparked a bit of interest back into the community to learn everyday languages, or you know, topical stuff like fishing, medicine, and stuff like that. And I'll let Mark do the rest.
No, you've got to come back at the end. Don't get away with that easy. If you just have a look at this picture, this is basically a railway station in Budapest, in Hungary, in Europe. And I'm going to play a sound file, and I'd just like you to see if you can figure out what that... It's in Hungarian, so you might speak Hungarian, one of you, in which case you'll know, but if you don't, see if you can figure out what it might mean. Okay, anyone idea what it might mean? Doors are closing. Please stand here, doors are closing. Even if you spoke Hungarian, you probably could understand it anyway. Still. So that's the thing. It's Hungarian, attention please, doors are closing, metro platform in Budapest. So the idea is that, now I'm going to stick closely to the text, otherwise I'll get completely carried away. As this example shows us, certain utterances are very closely tied to the context in which they're used. In the post-Second World War period, researchers began to explore implications of this relationship to develop more effective language teaching practices. They reasoned that language use is intimately tied to the context in which it's used. Thus, the language functions and structures needed to successfully communicate in a given situation could relatively easily be isolated. This idea is at the heart of things like the Berlitz language phrase books, etc., etc. However, such an approach was soon shown to be very restrictive, as the relationship between language and context use proved to be more complex than initially thought. Wilkins proposed instead that an analysis of the content of utterances most likely to occur in a given situation could reveal language forms most valued to learners. This underpins the approach we're taking to Māori revitalisation, language revitalisation in Jokmingen. So this is a overall schema of the project, but I'm not going to go through it, except to say the important issues faced by those interested in learning Māori Jokmingen is that there's now only one fluent speaker in the community, as Josie pointed out. Sheila Conway has been very active in teaching Māori in the last 20 to 30 years. However, age and ill health make this role increasingly difficult. On the other hand, at least 35 to 40 hours of recordings of Mangarai speakers, including Sheila Conway, are stored in the IATSIS, Australian Institute of Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander Studies, archive in Canberra. In this talk, we'll discuss aspects of a project to explore how these audio documents could be used to help create digital teaching and learning resources where speakers are scarce. Audio documents repatriated to a community are powerful simply by virtue of the voices contained on the recordings belonging to the ancestors and family members, even when content is no longer understood. However, for language learning purposes, comprehension is important, and longer utterances need to be broken down into smaller chunks and organised in some way to help make them digestible. So a chunk could be is any Mangarai word string, including single words that could be used to convey something meaningful in a given context. So context is important. In the early phases, we're looking at this research question, mouthful, so I won't even read it out. The important thing was the summary of the results show that Jukmingan community members were interested in learning some everyday language in Mangarai. Readily available programs such as PowerPoint could be useful for community resource creation. People are familiar with these kinds of resources and they're free and downloadable. Mobile phones are widely used in the community despite fairly poor coverage and could be useful devices for learning resources that were created using these. Chunking of longer recordings into smaller meaningful units has the potential to make them more manageable for learners and serve as exemplars for correct usage that learners can listen to and copy. Bearing in mind the community's preference for everyday language, we began developing a database of Mangarai chunks that we're currently calling chunk bank. Probably not a very nice word, but we'll find something in Mangarai that's appropriate. We adopted an organisational structure based on the Threshold 1990 framework, which is a framework developed by Van Eck and Trim under the auspices of the Council of Europe in post-war Europe, or in the 60s anyway. The objective of Threshold 1990 is to provide a comprehensive specification of the language required for successful communication in prescribed contexts at a basic or threshold level. We use three parameters derived from Van Eck and Trim's work, topic, subtopic, and language function. That is, what can you actually do with the language in that context or that topic? So chunks are transcribed. So this is what chunk bank looks like, basically a database. So you see topic, you can see subtopics here. Then you've got the transcription, English, should also be in Creole, because actually Creole is the language that's used in that community, but currently we haven't got that. Josie's next job. The sound file, which is hyperlinked to a series of files on my computer. That's problematic, as anyone who's tried to do that will know, that those links can easily get broken. And this is the speaker, so this is the metadata telling you who the speaker was, and this tells you where they came from, what's the source of it. So that's kind of the way that we've been thinking about it currently. So thinking about what you can do with this, you organise these chunks in this way, what can we do with it? So an important element of successful language revitalisation projects is that they be owned and driven by the community. This is not to say that external support should not play a role, but projects should aim to maximise community independence. So the fourth study we did was designed to investigate the kind of support that could help community members understand and use archival Mangarai audio materials with the greatest degree of independence. So we used a concept of scaffolding, which is one widely used in education. Originally, it was a metaphor taken by Wood et al. In 1976 to describe behaviour of an adult to support a child in solving a task by controlling those aspects of a task that are beyond the child's capacity, allowing them to focus on the things that they are able to do. In this case, the adult's seen as an expert and the child is seen as a novice, a side of expert novice. What Van der Poel et al. Did a meta-analysis of work using this concept, of studies using the concept, and they saw that there were three crucial elements that people were using when they were using this idea of scaffolding. One is contingency, one's fading, and the other's transfer of responsibility and ownership. So contingency requires the support to be at. So if you look here, so you've got contingency, fading, transfer. The support should be at or slightly above the level of the learner. Fading and transfer of responsibility are fairly related concepts, but it's the idea that the responsibility should transfer. So, of course, this, the metaphor is scaffolding. Scaffolding is something temporary. So any support that has to stay there or the whole building falls down is not going to be very useful. So they identify five reasons you might want to support a learner, which they say are scaffolding intentions. So you've got metacognitive domain, you've got direction. So it refers to keeping the learner on target and maintaining their pursuit. Cognitive structuring, explanatory and belief structures that organise or justify. Reduction of the degrees of freedom entails simplification of the task in some way. Recruitment, getting students interested in the task and helping them remain on task. And then contingency or frustration control is obviously aimed at trying to limit the frustrations for learners to the degree you can. Using rewards and, they say, punishments. In our context, we try to avoid the punishments. We stuck with confectionery rewards for the most part, chocolate, lollies, what do you mean? They also identified six scaffolding means around the side. That is how you scaffold. Feeding back, giving some kind of feedback to students, hints, clues that are not the whole answer, instructing, that's an explicitly telling people what to do, explaining, giving more detailed information, modelling, a demonstration of particular skills, or questioning. Scaffolding is constituted basically by any combination of these two. So you've got to have one of these and one of these, and then in their view you get some kind of scaffolding, as long as these things are present. Study 4 aims to answer this research question: how can captured Mangarai word strings, digital resources, making use of these scaffold independent learning? So the study was framed as an authentic task where participants worked in groups to create short videos based around subtopic sickness in the topic of health using Mangarai language. So the videos that they were to create could subsequently serve as Mangarai learning resources. The idea was to create a video around this topic. Scaffolding was offered of two kinds. One was face-to-face support from a linguist, and the other is this chunk bank resource. Data collection was video, audio, interviews, my observations, reflections, etc. So there's a whole range of stuff. The study was planned in three blocks. So initially we thought that the same people that we'd been working with before in the previous studies would be involved in these blocks, but it turned out they weren't available. So Josie's family was on holidays, so they'd lived in the community before but now live outside the community, so they were roped into being involved in this study, and it was really, really interesting.
That's what family's for. Yeah. When you can't find anyone else, you work with.
So I kind of took a more didactic approach to the first session than I probably planned to, because I wasn't sure how much they knew about Mangarai or what they expected out of it. So it was kind of a different thing. Turns out they know a lot more than I gave them credit for. The first session basically was pretty didactic, and I felt there was engagement. People were really interested. They sort of learned stuff, but it didn't seem to really... We lost sight of the end goal, which is creating these videos. So it was way too grammar-focused, too overwhelming. So we switched tack. Gemma's looking at me because it was basically her suggestion, but anyway. In session two, we basically... No? Why is it not going now? That one. There we go. In session two, we basically just said, okay, if you want to create a little conversation about this topic, in fact, you can just sort of go down there and choose one of these chunks out of each group, and you've got a little simple dialogue or simple conversation. So people did that, and then if they wanted to, they could add more or make it more or less complex. But that was a simple task. And people really got into that, I think, and it was a much more... positive kind of constructive experience. Okay. Yeah, technology. Great. Right, okay.
That was my brain when he started.
Oh, there we go. So sessions 3 and 4, I quickly, because we're running out of time, just go through, but we did some, they created a simple PowerPoint learning... Oh, fine. I saw two. I was really worried. We created some, basically so to help them remember, and then we did some filming. Then in the other sessions, it was really just, we went out and collected some bush medicine, and it was really filming and getting the language. And it was really interesting because we were able to bring it back to Sheila, who's the speaker. And we'd previously tried to sort of elicit some language by kind of miming, and but here we brought the things, we put it down and acted it out, and it was much easier for her to tell us. We got really interesting language about how you do those things and what words you might use. And then the next, what we also got some other community members, some older community members who have a stronger background knowledge in Mangarai. And what was really interesting, taking them out and using some of these words from the chunk bank, they remembered a lot. They could actually understand quite a lot. So we could begin to see what it means to say, I've got some background knowledge. Okay, so we'll just skip from there. So the big question is, who's the expert? So in the conception of this idea of scaffolding of an expert and a novice, but in this context, the expert, in Wood's terms, an expert is supporting a novice. In the context of Jilkmingan, it's difficult to assign binary expert-novice roles to those in the study. Although all participants have some knowledge of and experience with Mangarai, none has real mastery. Elder Sheila Conway is now the only member of the community who is an expert speaker. But as we said previously, age and health make it increasingly difficult for her to use this expertise in a teaching role. It is here that archival recordings of Sheila and other Mangarai speakers who have now passed away can play a role in giving utterance the imprimatur of authentic examples. So in this case, Chunkbank can perform the role of being the expert because it's people from the past who have that authority to say it. I'm going to skip over this a little bit in the interest of getting to someone who's got more important things to say, but this, you know, I have actually thought about how this chunk bank might relate to the framework that we set up so that, you know, it is actually doing the things that the framework suggested, scaffolding framework, set, possibly questioning, not sure how that fits in. Okay. Just quickly, I'll go to this one to say that one of the things we hadn't put in was this glossing. So I thought, oh, that might be overwhelming for people. I'll leave it out. But when talking to people, they said, actually, that could be quite a useful thing for us. So we decided to stick it back in, but not technical, and with colours to try and keep track to make it as opaque, as transparent as possible. And the thing is that this kind of, I guess, supports grammatical understanding. So, it is a way of teaching grammar without teaching grammar. And when you say to Josie, hey, Jose, let's go and have a grammar lesson, you'll see you're going that way very quickly. But really, this is grammar. So I'm just going to pass back to Josie to give some of her... we'll go back this way. Some of her impressions. There was a slide on
that. Mark just asked me what I thought of the project, and I thought the main thing is that it's 3 or 4 years long, so he's continuously coming back. Whereas projects in the past are like only, you got 3 or 6 months to do it, so it's very fast, and then you forget it, onto the next project kind of thing. So that was good. And also at the start, he asked everybody, what do you might want to learn? So they wrote down some sentences of what they wanted to learn, so some practical stuff, not just go in some language, learn kind of thing. And we did a canoe trip with the kids, and I thought, well, that'd be the best way to get some books and stuff into the school, is getting them out there. And, so doing the action, what's a boat, what's a paddle, what's river, what's this bush tucker here, and stuff like that. And that was going to be the second part of this, down the track kind of thing. But because we had sorry business, so I couldn't go back and do what we wanted to do, sort of like a celebration of the project, chuck on barbecue, whatever, and show all the videos of what everyone was involved in, show them the product kind of thing. So it ended up the other way around, so hopefully later, once sorry business finished, we can go back and do the celebration part of the project. But we've started doing that, and the kids have already written down in Creole what they'd like to learn in Māori. And that's it.
And I'd just like to say so that Josie's been so we talk a lot about sort of cooperative, linguists and community members and how does that work. Basically, without Josie, I really couldn't have done this project. So it worked because she was involved. She talked to community members. So I'd be sitting there on my own. If she hadn't gone out, and you know, I'd be thinking, well, no one's actually going to turn up. And suddenly all these people would be in because Josie had gone around and talked to Auntie and whatever, and there they were. And they were involved because they trusted her, they trusted me. So it's a, and you know, we've known each other since 1994, one way or another. So it's a genuine partnership, I think. And Josie's been doing all the editing of the videos. I'm incapable of editing a video, so she's been doing all that work. So what we'd just like to do is leave you with a word from Auntie Sheila, who's got this to say.
Teacher, hello.
Thank you. Yes.
I was wondering, what types of audio were the most useful to you? Because you mentioned using data from audio from archives,
yeah.
But then a lot of this is just audio
conversational
speech.
Yeah, so originally the reason that I came to do it this way is because I started a project in 1994. I'm a language teacher. And then I went up to that community because, well, I was doing a Master of Philosophy and that was my project. But they were looking to teach the Mangarai to the students in the school, so they needed some language teaching pedagogy strategies. So that was my job, which was fantastic, by the way. A French teacher suddenly going, wow, how do I teach this language in this context? It's a great challenge and beautiful to have to be involved in. So I spent a lot of time asking the sort of questions that I would ask as a language teacher, which so I organised things in topics. I asked questions like, so if you're talking about sickness, I was talking particularly to an old lady called Amy Nierengeik, saying, Amy, how do you say, you know, I've got a sore leg or I'm sick? So I asked those kinds of questions and she gave me those kinds of answers, which it might sound like, oh, well, that's easy because you just say that and you get the answer. But actually, as it turns out, because she spoke a really heavy form of Creole, that and I'd never come across this language in my life, so I often really didn't know what she was saying, supposedly speaking English. So, for example, one time I asked, so, Amy, how do you say I'm really angry? And she said, Waro Gangama. I said, no, I'm really angry. Waro Gangama. I thought, oh, I'm pretty sure that's what it is. So I was convinced this means I'm really angry. What actually meant was I'm really hungry. So she'd misunderstood me, I'd misunderstood her. So it's not a straightforward thing to do. So the point is that initially I've used that. There's another corpus of Mangarai, which is a really big corpus from 1978. So Dr. Francesca Merlin lived there for a whole year. She's the one who wrote the grammar and did the dictionary. She's done all the basic work that's allowing us now to do this kind of stuff. And there's a huge corpus of that stuff in IATSIS that we've got access to, and it's of a very different nature, as you say. And so I've had a listen to it and think, I say, how can that fit into this kind of thing? And basically it can, but I think it would require a lot more work to find that chunk and where it goes. And the other thing I'd say, and Francesca herself pointed this out, is that, well, if someone tells a story, so sometimes data, you know, the stuff you get is a story. Well, you don't want to break the story up and put it all in chunks all over the place and lose that connection. So you know, I think each set of data is going to present its own issues, but this is the one we've sort of been working with.
I might have missed it, but I'm wondering if you talk a little bit about the process of making those chunks, extracting
yeah.
those
yeah.
files.
So far it's me just going through my old recordings and going, there's that, I've transcribed it. And so it's data I know really well, and just breaking it up in ways that I think seem sensible, making a new file, labelling it in English, and then thinking, okay, what can I do with this? So it's working, I always think it's working backwards from how a language teacher would work. As a language teacher, you define a context, you say, oh, wouldn't it be good to be able to say this? You find someone who's a speaker of that language, say, oh, can you record this? You know, here you're going backwards, saying, well, I've got this, what can I do? You know, what context, what can it do? So it's sort of working backwards. But with one of the studies we did was just looking at community members and saying, well, what if I give you an 8-minute chunk of Amy, you know, this audio data like I have, what can you do with that? And everyone could sort of break it up into sort of chunks and find things. But it was obviously much harder. I'm a trained linguist. It's much harder for them to be able to sort of necessarily transcribe it or do all that stuff. But so, you know, that's a partnership. But.
Could you also say more about how the chunks were presented to people in the community when you were making the script and so on? Like, was it primarily presented as audio or primarily presented as text or both?
Primarily audio, but one of the sort of studies we did was actually just to see what role written text can play. So, you know, as language teachers, we tend to think, especially for little kids, you want to keep written words away and just have people listening to stuff. But actually, quite often people feel like it's a good thing to hang on to. I don't know, could you say something about that? Do you feel like when you see the written word, is it a bit less scary than just hearing this stuff coming at you? Or?
Well, I've learned to read Māori now. Linguists that I've worked with over the years have taught me how to read it. And so now I suppose I rely a bit on written thing now. It'll help me sort of thing. Because if I listen, I have a bad memory, I forget. But most of our mob are very audio. So they'll listen because they haven't learned to read Māori or Creole, which is our first language now, which is sort of like just a dialect of English.
And as a follow-up, so when people were putting the chunks together to make a dialogue or a script, did they sort of memorize as they went along if they were doing it in audio?
The idea was that when they'd selected their little kind of catalogue, when we did this little study, then they just got a PowerPoint. They opened a PowerPoint and saved those chunks into the PowerPoint so that they could go home and practice them.
So they actually put all the files in order.
Yeah, because the idea of this is it's not a learning resource necessarily. Like, I think it can be, but the idea is if you get all these audio chunks, then you can create learning resources from that. So using a selection of these, you've got them captured. If you want to build it, so on my phone right here, I've got about 20 learning resources that we've made using chunks that we've captured. The other thing I'd say, of course, anyone who's worked with audio knows that the quality of audio is very variable. So sometimes it's quite not great. And there are two things that are bad about it. Or bad. One is the quality might not be great, but the good thing about it is that someone like Josie can see it written and she's got a model to listen to. So it gives her, I think, more confidence, to, even if she doesn't never seen that phrase before, to repeat it and mimic it. So she becomes, you know, she creates, re-speaks, if you like, these audio things. The second thing I'd say is that sometimes they're very fast. So even with Amy, I'd say, oh, Amy, could you say that one a little bit more slowly? I'd have to say that Josie's aunt is fantastic at speaking slowly and clearly. Aunty Sheila, she's super. But sometimes using the... we found if you slowed it by 20%, it can just take the edge off. If you go too far, you end up with something, raw. It sounds a little bit weird. But working with 20%, so you can just take the edge off it a little bit.
Happened there because we were having trouble with technology because it wasn't really good technology there and then we tried to like depends on what kind of PowerPoint you had, if your phone had that same thing, and then if we took it to the school, they had an older version, so it wasn't working. So all these little things end up becoming a bit of a roadblock to the learning, so it's definitely slowed things down. But at least, you know, what they did take away from that block, they've gone back and shared it with the family at home, because the younger kids come back and say something, what was that word? And I know they weren't there when we were doing it, so obviously the family members have taken it back. So the younger generation come back, what's that word?
And you were saying too that in general there's been in the community there's just been a rise in the you know, Mungerai has always been there. So I guess two things I'd say. One is that it's always been there, but the, you know, Aunt Sheila's getting older, and she herself has said, you might be going to learn this because I'm not going to be around forever. And I think there's an awareness now that actually, you know, it may not be there one day. So I think there's that, and I think this project is sort of, I just feel like there's a more awareness in the community. People are getting involved. So that ILA grant you guys put in together, so you want to talk about that?
Yes, I might help my older sister apply for an ILA grant.
It's just a grant from the Australian government for community work.
And we're hoping to continue like taking this chunk of stuff to go learn with and keep going with it, and not just sit there, like a lot of resources end up doing after a project's finished.
Well, see, Josie's canoe thing, so she's going out, taking the kids out. You know, it's really context-based. This project is working through the art centre where they want to go out and make clapsticks, so get the older people, take them out, clapsticks, decorate it, film it, document it. So it's clapsticks, coolamans and mats, I think. So they're three sort of projects. So it's taking this context idea, I guess, and just trying to keep pushing that.
Thank you.
Thanks so much. I think we're out of time. Thank you.
Thank you.